There is two fools and an idea. Why would anybody invest in you, right? You have to be a good storyteller, right, in order to raise money. When people ask me what are the most important things, my advice to them is find the right partner. It is absolutely critical. Why? Because it's very, very hard to start a business out of nothing. And it's very hard when two people do it, let alone if you go solo. It's like almost impossible. People do that, you know, they're great examples, but it's extremely difficult. You know, your odds of succeeding are that much higher if you find the right partner.
Yes.
But it all hinges on the right partner. So there's a huge opportunity in front of us. And if we do this right, we can build this into a multi-billion dollar business, not valuation, I'm talking about revenue. And at what point am I going to consider myself successful? I don't look at it that way. And I know that I'm going to feel the same way. So these are just numbers, you know, adding zeros or whatever. And so I had to ask myself, what is success in last year? And I think success is not what you've accomplished, but what you've left behind.
This podcast episode is supported by EBRD. Support to small and medium-sized businesses is an important part of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's mandate. Activities to support small businesses include direct and indirect financing through partner institutions. The EBRD's Advice for Small Businesses team provides the knowledge, the network, and the skills to help emerging businesses innovate, thrive, and succeed.
Hello, Recursive community, and welcome back to our podcast series. My next guest is on a quest to redefine the way businesses collaborate and work with data in the cloud. With more than 20 years of experience in building successful enterprise software products, Georgi Dochev is the co-founder and the CTO of the US-Bulgarian scale-up, LucidLink. The company's solution is used by the biggest names in media, in health, finance industry, namely Adobe, Spotify, WebMD. At the end of 2023, LucidLink closed the largest round for the Bulgarian ecosystem, $75 million Series C. Is LucidLink now on its way to becoming the next Bulgarian unicorn? We're going to find out from Georgi. Welcome to our podcast. I'm very happy that you're here.
Thank you for having me.
We've been thinking of inviting you for quite some time. We weren't sure how long you're in the country. When are we going to be able to meet you in person? And it is today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Congratulations on your your last round. It's been very impressive.
Thank you. We've gone through several rounds. The latest one, I think, is a validation of our business model and where we are as a company today.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's just a stepping stone or a milestone to bigger and better things yet to come.
We are neighbors with Brightcap Ventures in Better House.
All right.
So in a way, I could always sense the faith that at least your investors have in you. And we've been just waiting for the company to explode over time. Before we start our conversation, I would like to bring you a bit back in time when you left Bulgaria in the 90s. You built a career as a software engineer later on in the States. You worked mostly for one company, DataCore Software. I guess you were happy there. How did you grow an appetite to start your own venture from this point?
Mm-hmm. So the reality is that I didn't want to start my company. And in fact, I didn't even want to go to the US. I went to the US because my then girlfriend didn't want to come back to Bulgaria and live with me. And so I went there kicking and screaming, basically. Like everybody else wanted to move to the US or immigrate there. I thought I liked it here. Now, of course, in hindsight, this was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life, but it was fairly accidental. And similarly, I went to the US, I found this company, DataCore Software, which was a great, fantastic team of people. You know, I fell in love with the people, I fell in love with the company and how it's treated its employees. And I stayed there, and I stayed there for many years. I think it was maybe around 18 years.
18 years.
Yeah. So, you know, I started out as one of the, you know, proper co-founders because I worked without getting paid for a year. So I consider myself a co-founder of the company. And over the years, I grew up to lead the engineering team there. But at some point, I kind of reached a plateau in my career. There was nowhere else to go, essentially. So I was getting itchy to do something else. And when I finally left around 2015, I didn't really think I would build a successful business. It was more like, let me see how far I can get. Let me test myself. Of course, I'm going to fail like everybody else.
So you didn't want to start your own company. How came that you did?
Right. So it's not that I didn't, but I didn't think that I would succeed. You know, okay. When you start thinking about these things, you know, if you're sensible, you're going to read a couple of books about entrepreneurship. You look online and you quickly realize that the odds are against you and the chances of actually building successful business are slim to none. And who am I to do that? And so so what I wanted to do is to just test myself. The basic assumption was, okay, I'm going to fail like everybody else out there, and that's okay. Let me see how far I can get, you know.
So you were eager to challenge yourself or to maybe expand your learning and, I don't know, collect new experiences?
It was more of a challenge, testing okay. myself. See how far you can get. Okay. See what you're made of. And by the way, that's probably a good reason to start a business. If you want to start a business for money or fame, you're not going to get very far. It's mm-hmm. too hard. It's too long. It's too painful. Nobody cares about these things that much, you know? Mm-hmm. And there are much easier ways to get rich or whatever you're after. But if it's something that is internal, if you have a drive, you have something, some inner need to do something, to test yourself, to accomplish something, some kind of fulfillment, I think that's more permanent and more powerful. And maybe you have a higher chance of going through all these trials and tribulations that are awaiting you. Lena?
I totally agree here. At the same time, I'm thinking that especially first-time entrepreneurs, they might not know themselves that much internally. So the internal motivation could not be that visible or that clear. I mean, you write something on your pitch deck that sounds great because you have a mission and you want to have impact in the world, and this is what investors are buying. But I think this self-knowledge comes often after. I needed to face a lot of my shadows and devils when I became an entrepreneur and also a leader of a team. Then you start thinking of, okay, what are my internal struggles? How am I going to deal with them? Anyway, I just...
100%. Yeah. And you're not going to know it. And again, reading those books, you read these horror stories of other businesses, the ups and downs and the hardships and whatnot. And then you read the books and you're like, okay, it's not going to happen to me. Now I know, right? I'm going to avoid all these pitfalls. And then it happens to you. And so you're going to be tested in the worst possible ways. And so, yeah, you're going to learn a lot about yourself in the process. And by the way, it's not about learning as much as it is growing or on-the-job training. You know, you're not born who you are today. You're training yourself constantly, and you get better over time. And so, again, it's a question of how far you want to take it.
I wonder if there was a situation where you thought, okay, that's a challenge the startup founders have, and I'm going to avoid it, or, okay, now I see how they dealt with it. And then it happens to you, and you're like, I thought I'm more prepared for that. I didn't see that coming, but it is exactly as it was in the books. Can you remember a situation like
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Look, there's this book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And I started reading the book. I got so depressed that I stopped reading it. To this day, I haven't finished the book because I saw myself in the book and I'm like, okay, I can't do this. You know, I can read this book. And as far as examples, there's so many of them, you don't know where to start, but look, The people, first, when you start out, you know, you think you're going to start this company with the people who were closest to you, your friends, your colleagues, etc., that, you know, you spend a significant amount of time with and you trusted them, etc. And they're all going to leave you for various reasons, for good reasons, because mm-hmm. they don't believe in what you believe. They have families. They work hard over the years to get to where they are in life, and now they have to abandon all this and start running in the opposite direction. And there are many good excuses or reasons. So at some point, when you're about to start, you are all alone. So, first challenge, and then you start raising money, and you're not raising money in the best possible circumstances. You're raising money in the worst possible circumstances because, you have a newborn and you're running out of money and your dad will get a heart attack and on and on and on and on, So it just piles up. And that's how it is. And everybody's, I'm not unique in that situation. I'm just telling you how it was for me. And that's how it is for everybody.
Yeah. I'm looking at the entrepreneurial path from today's perspective a bit more as a personal growth path. I don't think that, the result that I was envisioning back then is that relevant to me. I'm sometimes just looking back and I'm thinking, I'm actually proud that I've learned so much over the time, that I've also developed a certain self-consciousness about myself and what is actually happening in me internally. So that maybe I'm a bit wiser now than it was like 5 years ago.
That's also very true. What I say is that I've learned in the past 5 years way more than I learned in the previous 20.
Yeah.
Because before that, I also learned a lot, but in different ways. And it's different when you work for someone else, you work for a corporation. Not everything depends on your decisions, and it's not a life or death. Usually it's, it's less dramatic than that. When you start your own business and every decision will determine the outcome, whether you continue on this path or it's game over, it's a lot more stressful. And that puts you in that position of constant growth and constant learning.
Mm-hmm.
From a learning perspective, it doesn't get better than this.
How about success stories? Were they able to lift you up, to motivate you to go further? Were there a tool for you to, keep your optimism and slight delusion that you're going to succeed? Did you feed your brain with success stories as well? I think because we're in media, we constantly do that. I also admit that I think we create, in a way, very unrealistic expectations in founders of how startup life is, what valuations are, what funding rounds look like.
Right.
We're part of the problem.
So this is a question of what is success? And at some point, you have to try to answer this for yourself. I don't know how other people look at it. Over the years, we've had these successful points in time. Ultimately, startup companies depend on gated capital. So it's like going through these exams, and you have to do everything right to get to the next point where you get the next investment round, etc. So you can look at these points in time as successes. I personally don't, because by many measures today, you can say we're successful, right? But if you ask me, I don't consider myself successful. We're just scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, where we are today, maybe 3 years from now, we're going to be $100 million in revenue, and then $200 million in revenue, and $1 billion in revenue one day if everything goes right. And at what point am I going to consider myself successful? I don't look at it that way. And I know that I'm going to feel the same way. These are just numbers, adding zeros or whatever. And so I had to ask myself, what is success in last year? And I think success is not what you've accomplished, but what you've left behind. In other words, for me, and that might change over time, but for me, if another five companies spawn off of our company and they get to where we are and beyond, that's probably real success. Because then you get this multiplicative effect of what you've done. So that's how I define it these days, and time will tell.
I love this perspective. We've been talking about this perspective exactly with Vasil Terziev, because I think Telerik created this kind of like a multiplier effect.
A great example of this.
Exactly. And yes. I think, you know, then you have the UiPath story, which was in Romania. And here we also come to the fact that you have to start considering ESOP sooner than later, so that you can actually share the success with other people, especially in our part of the world where companies quite often are have to move their headquarters somewhere else and their IP somewhere else. And I think this is the way you actually bring back the success and the wealth to others. And most probably in your own company, you have developed certain entrepreneurial mindset, not only in yourself, but also in people who are working with you. So they might be more willing to start their own companies.
Absolutely. The best way is to see someone else doing it. The reason, by and large, I started my company is because I saw how it was done at Datacore. Because we had this motley crew of, you know, 10 people who, looking from the outside, there was no reason why we would succeed. And we built a fairly large business. You know, when I left the company in 2015, we're at 50, 60 million in revenue. Fast forward to today, that's probably, you know, north of $100 million revenue business. So we built a successful business out of nothing. And when you see that, when you're part of it, it gives you that internal power. You know it can be done. I've seen this happen. Mm-hmm. I can probably do it myself. Of course, the odds are against you and all that, but you've seen this happen. And so the the people on our team today, they're going through the same thing. We built this from the ground up, from zero to where we are today. And so they know how it's done, and hopefully they'll do it themselves one day.
I believe in even probably more challenging circumstances than it was for Datacore. Oh, do you still have a relationship to the co-founders of Datacore?
So the two co-founders are George Teixeira and Zia Rall. Unfortunately, Zia passed away, but I occasionally, still communicate with George. I have great respect for them. Until you do it yourself, you don't know how hard it is. Mm-hmm. And now in hindsight, actually look up to these guys and say, wow, this was not easy. Kudos to you guys. I didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah,
of course, I still value them as people. I still looked up to them. I had great respect for them. But it's different now. Now it's like, oh, okay. Now I know, you know.
I wonder also how they would relate to your achievements so far. I can only guess that they also feel, I don't know, like as if they have contributed to the world in a positive way.
I hope so.
Effect, yes.
Let me give you another example. Datacore did a lot of things right, one of which is that it really treated its people well.
Mm-hmm.
They really, truly cared about their people. You know, it was a rare, rare company in that sense. And of course, when Peter and I started LucidLink, we said, okay, let's take the best of Datacore and apply it. And one of those things was, you take care of your people first, and we're trying to pay that forward, you know? And so that comes from Datacore. I didn't invent anything. I just saw it.
I wonder what that means, because I believe that especially tech companies being in a situation when they need to grow, where there is scarcity of good engineers, most of them would say, we treat our employees great and we have all these benefits. Mm-hmm. What did it mean for Datacore back then, and what does it mean for LucidLink now?
Yeah. Right. Look, treating people well doesn't mean free lunch or breakfast or, you know, pool tennis or office. I'm not talking about any of that.
I see. Okay. Interesting.
It's different. I'll give you an example with me. I worked maybe a little bit too hard, and I got to a point where I developed this chronic tendonitis, and I just kept pushing to a point where I just couldn't use my hands. I couldn't even brush my teeth. So I had to stop working for a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, completely, like I just stopped. And in fact, I thought that was the end of my career. But it's not about me. What's interesting about the story is not me. It's actually how my former company treated that. They said, you know what, George? We're going to pay you 80% of your salary for as long as you need. And that was it. And I stayed at home for a year and I got paid. I don't think a lot of companies today are going to do that. So that's mm-hmm. that's a real test. You know, mm-hmm. do you really care? Well, that's what it takes. Mm-hmm.
Really impressive.
Not the table tennis and all these other things.
Yeah, that's really impressive. Okay. And how do you apply that now at Lucid Link?
Well, I would rather have my team speak to that than me. But I'm trying to apply the same principles.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody really needs help, the company is there to help them. Whether it's a medical condition, whether you need some time off, or whatever it is, you know. But like I said, I'd rather have other people speak to that.
Yeah, I can see that you have a certain humility in your art of speaking and presenting yourself. And still, I'm going to push you to share even more because I think your journeys could be inspirational for one of the people that are in the audience. Tell me about Peter. How did you meet? Why Peter? And what did you learn about picking the right co-founder for your next journey?
Right. So this is probably one of the most important questions. And the reason is that when people ask me what are the most important things, my advice to them is find the right partner. It is absolutely critical. Why? Because it's very, very hard to start a business out of nothing. And it's very hard when two people do it, let alone if you go solo. It's like almost impossible. People do that. You know, they're great examples, but it's extremely difficult. Your odds of succeeding are that much higher if you find the right partner.
Yes.
But it all hinges on the right partner, not any partner. And this kind of partnership is like, marrying somebody. You know, you don't know what's going to happen.
I think it's even more binding sometimes.
And in some ways, in theory, you can divorce your wife, but you can't divorce your partner. I mean, maybe you can, yeah. But it's very, very disruptive. It's very emotionally, financially difficult, etc. And so there are certain irreversible decisions when you start a business, and this is one of those, or very hard to reverse decisions, let me put it this way. And so finding the right person is critical. And why Peter? I don't know. It was a subconscious decision. When I started out and I was by myself, I was living in Barcelona at the time. I moved the family back to the U.S. and I asked myself, okay, who are the people who could be my partner that I know? And only one name came up. It was Peter, and I gave him a call, and he jumped at this opportunity. And I actually, over the years, and by the way, we had worked together. We weren't close friends at the time. We mm-hmm. just knew each other and had apparently great respect for one another. And over the years, that partnership turned into a friendship. And so I can say that now we operate as an atomic unit. You know, all the strategic decisions we make together as a team. You know, in companies, you have these roles or titles, CEO, CTO. These things don't matter to me and Peter. People try to put us in boxes. I'm going to talk to Peter because he's the CEO. I'm going to talk to George because it doesn't work that way internally. We operate as a unit. Mm-hmm. And it's the best thing that's ever happened. But it's not easy. Over the years, Peter became my best friend. And probably that's the best you can hope for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. And I guess you still have different qualities. Otherwise, it wouldn't really make sense for you to start the business together. I mean, one of them would be too much.
We complement each other That is absolutely true. We're very different in some ways.
But it's
that complementary nature that actually works well, which is true for any partnership in families, and your spouse is probably the same.
Most of the partnerships are built on complementary skills, and still I believe it requires a certain maturity to tolerate differences, to accept the differences, I don't know, to deal with your own ego. How was it for you? How did you go through that period in the partnership where you had to understand that the person on the other side, they think in a different way, and this is why I actually picked them up, and they could, maybe, I don't know, they drive me crazy, maybe. Yeah. I don't know if that's an emotion that you had.
The funny thing is, I never had this problem with Peter. Okay. I think we both checked our egos at the door and then started working. And as long as you do that, it's fine. And again, it's kind of a little bit like marriage in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're fighting for dominance in a marriage, that's not a successful formula. And this is very similar. We've got too many problems to deal with. There's no time to argue with one another, you know? At least I never looked at it that way, and neither did Peter.
Mm-hmm. They say that the team or the founding team is also the most important thing for investors. Still, when you were fundraising for the first time, I hear that you had challenging times. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah.
Why so?
Well, for the obvious reasons. Yeah, you know, there's two fools and an idea. Why would anybody invest in you, right?
But VCs are looking exactly for those, aren't they?
True.
Yeah, it's when it's their business.
That is true. That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
However, in the early stages, all you have is an idea. And you have the founding team.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be a good storyteller, right? Yeah. In order to raise money, because you only have a story. You got nothing to show for it. There is no product, or maybe there is a POC. There is some, you know, there may be some proof points, but for the most part, there's not much. So there's a lot of hand waving going on, and in fact, there's a lot of hand waving going on the first couple of rounds, because you first have a technology, then a technology, a feature, a product, a business. You know, you're going to need time to get to those later stages where you have proof points. Early on, it's all ideas. And so it is invariably difficult. When we started, it was sort of the first collision with reality, you know? Mm-hmm.
How many notes did you take?
Oh, 30 plus.
30 plus.
Yeah. But you know what? It doesn't seem so bad now in hindsight, because even in series, for our last round in Series C, I think we've talked to more than 50 funds for a different reason. There was a lot of inbound interest. And in fact, we had to turn down investors, which I never thought it would happen, but there was just too many of them. Mm-hmm. But going back to the first investment, it is by far the hardest, because you're going to meet a lot of people who are more successful than you. They've done it many, many times. In some cases, they're smarter than you. They certainly have more experience and they have knowledge of the industry. And all of them will tell you that it's not going to work for many, many reasons. And there's obviously many reasons why this is a foolish idea. And so... you have to sort of maintain conviction, but by the same token, you have to have humility and stay open-minded, because in our case, and I think that's true for a lot of companies, you have to pivot. And we went through a pivot early on. Mm-hmm. I still remember the original idea at the time was to connect multiple geographically distributed locations and form sort of an overlay network. Create a span, a file system that is working across these different branch offices. Mm-hmm. There was no cloud in that original idea. And so we talked to, I forgot his name, the head of the Innovation Endeavors. This was Eric Schmidt's fund. He was a Stanford professor. And we pitched to him, very smart guy. And he said, guys, all of my portfolio companies are now in the cloud. This makes no sense. Nobody's going to put data on-premise. And here's the interesting thing. At the time, this wasn't the case. It was the case within his portfolio companies, and those were forward-looking companies. So he was actually seeing what's around the corner 5 years from now. It wasn't the present, it was the future.
Yeah.
And we went back home and we said, something's not right here. And we sort of revisited the original idea and said, you know what? We're going to go to the cloud, and we're going to re-architect the solution so that it's a cloud first. All the data is in the cloud, and then it's accessible from each and every location. And so we pivoted midway. And so you see, you're walking a fine line between being sort of a naive fool and lacking conviction. And you have to be, you have to have conviction. You have to believe in yourself. You have to be assertive. And you also have to constantly question yourself and adjust. And it's a fine line.
It's a very fine line.
I was just about that needle.
Ask you, how do you know, are you still on the right side? Because for me, especially in the beginning, you know, I was someone who would listen to people's feedback, but I felt at some point as if I'm schizophrenic because, you know, I have all these voices telling me that this is not going to work, or I should do that, and this is not going to work this way. And of course, you know, at some point you have your own voice, but it's so... you can't hear it anymore because you have all these smarter, more experienced, more successful people in around you who are telling you not to do it like this.
Yeah.
And I think part of being an entrepreneur is to be able to say, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm not going to listen to so many people who are telling me how they believe. It's because that's my path.
That's exactly what it takes. They're not going to have your experience. They have their own experience, and they have more experience than you in all likelihood. But they're not going to have your unique experience, and they're also human. And so, you know, things they don't know, but you don't know that when you start talking to them.
I started thinking also about all those sleepless nights where you think about how you're going to hack a certain problem. They don't have these nights. That's another thing.
Well,
they do know
in some ways,
smart, yeah.
In some ways, it's, look, it's not easy to be an investor. Either.
Oh, no. Of course not. I'm not.
Investment is, you know, investing money is an act of courage. It's not a simple thing. But then again, you know, they have different sets of problems.
I'm thinking that certain people are maybe a bit more convinced or sometimes too convinced of themselves. And then you have the other people who are on the other side of the spectrum, who are much more they're listening to others, they're pleasers, they conform with...
That's right.
Society. And I think it's very important, and this is why self-knowledge here comes again in play, to know on which side of the spectrum are you, so that you know in which direction you need to correct yourself. You know, I remember at some point learning how to be a leader, I realized that in many ways I was a bit a people's pleaser, and I wasn't harsh enough. I wasn't defining enough which are the limits of how are we going to work together in this company. And that was creating a problem for me. At the same time, if you open the books and the podcast, everyone would be telling you, servant leaders, and you need to eat last. And and that wasn't valid for me because I was already doing a bit too much of it. So, yeah, sorry for...
Well, no, that's exactly what it is. That's why I said you're walking a fine line, because paradoxically, you need to be both. You need to be humble and open-minded, and you have to be assertive and believe in yourself. And if you sway on each side, you're going to get it wrong. And so it's a fine balance. And you never find that balance. You're always course correcting, you know? To this day, not everybody will agree with my management style, but it's working. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I'm finding something that's working. I'm happy with the things that I do. I can look myself in the mirror. I know I'm doing the right things, but not everybody's going to agree with you all the time. So you can't please everybody. Mm. You know, it doesn't work that way. On the other hand, you have to do what's right. At least that's my formula. You have to be ethical, you know, because, you know, the investment ecosystem is built in a way that, you know, it almost encourages, or if not condones, bad behavior. So there's a lot of bad behavior going on. That's not how we built our business. We're trying to do what's right first and foremost. But it's not, that doesn't mean that everybody will like it.
Really?
You know?
Yeah. Because I don't have that often entrepreneurs who have come so far like you. I'm wondering how the management, or rather the leadership style, changes over time. Because I can imagine that it's one thing to lead a team in the beginning, in the early stages, and it's another thing when, I don't know, you've just raised 75 million.
Mm-hmm.
And you have now around 60 people?
No, we have about 130 people around the world. Yeah.
Okay, around the world. Mm-hmm.
It's still a small team, but exactly. It's growing.
Yeah. It's still, yeah. How did you change your leadership style over time?
Well, let's start from the beginning. At first of all, I'm a technologist. I primarily work with computers, or I used to. Before I became an entrepreneur, then you have to do everything right. But at first, for many, many years, I was a technologist at heart. It's a lot easier to work with computers than to work with people. When you become an entrepreneur, you start your own religion. You know, you have to tell stories. You have to fire up people. You have to make them believe in what you believe, and all these things. It requires fundamentally different skills, almost diametrically opposite of what you used to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first transition. And then what happens is that every year your job description changes as you grow, because in our business, everything is about growth. The business must grow or you die. You know, if you grow at 20-30%, you might as well just, you know, throw in the towel. So you have to grow. But growth means you have to grow yourself. You have to grow with the company. And growing is painful. Growing means you're constantly doing things you don't know anything about. You know, you're mm-hmm. constantly unprepared. Like I said, your job description changes year on year. What I did last year is not what I'm doing this year. It's not going to be what I'm doing next year. So I'm constantly feeling unprepared and uncomfortable. And that's kind of what it takes.
Do you get used to that over time?
It's getting a little easier.
Yeah.
But coming to this podcast, I don't want to do it because I don't do podcasts, you know? I'm an introvert. I disguise it well, but I'm an introvert. I don't want to do podcasts. But I think I find this important. It's important mm-hmm. for me. It's important for the business.
Yeah.
I want to spread the word. I want to tell people what we're doing. And so that's required of me. So there is another example.
Thank you for saying that, because I have a lot of entrepreneurs who don't want to do podcasts, and they don't want to do interviews, and they don't want to be public at all.
That's how it is. Most entrepreneurs are introverts. You know, they're not extra. I mean, they're exceptions, of course. But
They are.
We work in closed environments, you know. In a small room without windows.
Yeah.
And that's where the magic happens. It doesn't happen on camera, but you got to do these things as well.
True.
About that and how you change. Well, you have to grow. You have to find yourself. You have to believe in yourself more and more over time. Mark Templeton, who's the former CEO of Citrix and on our board of directors and a mentor, he told us once that when he was the CEO of Citrix Systems, which is one of the largest corporations in America, he realized that the growth of Citrix was determined by his personal growth. And so mm-hmm. that was capping, you know, and limiting how far that company would go. And so he had to grow as a person. And of course, he had a plan. He talked to the board of directors. He was doing many, many things to sort of address his personal deficiencies as a leader and as a human so that the company can grow. And we're in the same situation. A lot of times, you start out as an entrepreneur, you're doing things right within the context of that stage of the company, which are totally the wrong things to do 5 years later. So for instance, you start out and everything is a controlled chaos. When you reach to 100, 150 people, controlled chaos doesn't work anymore. You have to get structured, you have to get organized. So all the traits and the mode of operation you used to work so well with are now you have to throw out the window and do it the opposite way. And that's this, you know, uncomfortable growth that you go through.
And this personal growth that needs to happen along the way, I guess also aspirations need to grow over time. Because you started just by testing yourself. I'm not quite sure that your ambitions were as big as they are probably today.
No, they were not.
How do you work on that? You personally, what did you do?
Mm-hmm.
How did you work on yourself over time?
I don't know. I think it happened naturally.
Okay.
I certainly didn't have any idea that we would get this far. But now that we're here, I think we can do a lot more. And like I said, we're just scratching the surface. There is a lot more that we can do. But at some point, you have to realize that in our world, in the software SaaS world, on one hand, you have a lot of opportunities because you can sell to the entire world. It's software over the internet, right? It's delivered over the internet. So you're not tied to a certain geography. It's not like I have a restaurant and I can only sell to people who are in this city. You sell to the entire world. By the same token, everybody can do that, which necessarily means that you are competing with the best of the best in the world. And so at some point you have to say, okay, I have to be the best in what I do. You carve out this segment that you're operating in and you say, I'm going to be the best in the world doing this. I cannot be, okay, maybe you're second best, third. Nobody's ever heard if you're the fourth. Like, they don't even know your name. So you have to be in the top two or three. And ideally, you want to be number one. And, you know, you have to believe at some point that you can do this. You can pull this off.
I think what you're offering, you're really competing to not only the best in the world, you're competing to the top companies in the world, yeah, at mm-hmm. this point. How much guts do you need to have to compete against, I don't know, Amazon and Google's in the world?
I don't know if it's about guts. We don't directly compete with the Amazon and Google and Microsoft today, although to some extent we do.
Mm-hmm.
They're not our direct competitors. They might become our direct competitors.
Okay.
At first, you're like, who am I to compete with these guys? At some point, you realize, wait a minute, I've built something that they haven't, and maybe there is a chance. And so what you need to do as your business scales up is to run as fast as you can to get to that market leadership position. And that's your only chance. Because once you get there, you control a substantial portion of the market, 30% plus, 40%, 50% if you're extremely lucky. Then you can sit back and relax a little bit, but not before that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we ought to do. We need to get to that leadership segment, leadership position where everybody who's a potential customer knows our name. We become an indispensable tool. Mm-hmm. They rely on us for their mission critical work. When you get there, you're in a good position, and you're going to be very hard to dislodge, even by the top companies in the world, because at some point they have to make a decision, build or buy.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, it might be actually better off buying your company than competing against you. That's not necessarily the case today. It certainly wasn't the case a couple of years ago, but I believe we can get there over time in the next couple of years, where they're going to have to really look at this hard and question it. Okay, can we build this? And there's no doubt that all these companies have the resources and the talent and the money to build what we have built, but it's going to take them time. And we're not sitting still in the meantime. We're marching forward. We're not living in a static state. It's a dynamic world, and they're moving, and we're moving too. So we just have to run faster. As I say, startups are in the business of compressing time. That's the only thing we can do. We don't have more resources. We don't have more talent. We're talented, just like they are, but we can go faster.
Another challenge that startups have is convincing big established brands to work with them. Because, mm-hmm. of course, especially for mission-critical work, you want on your provider, vendor, to be existent in the next 5 years, which is not always the case with
That's right.
startups. So how do you land customers like Spotify, Adobe, we mentioned before, which is also an investor in the meanwhile, WebMD? How do you convince them? What was, or at least for LucidLink, what was the winning argument?
Mm-hmm. So there's no sales strategy per se. You don't convince them. What you got to do is create a tool or technology or whatever service that they really, truly need. And in our case, the convincing was done by the pandemic. I didn't do it. We were at the right place in the right time. But ultimately, when the pandemic hit and everything fell apart, basically, the way they had structured their work, everybody goes to an office, they collaborate out of an office environment, etc. All that ceased overnight to exist, right? Mm-hmm. And so they had to find a way to work remotely. And they were scrambling, you know, they were trying to find, and there was no solution on the market. And we came along and we said, we've got a solution for you. Hmm. They were skeptical, but they had no chance. And they tried it and it worked, And over time they became more and more reliant. There's no going back now. But it was ultimately the pandemic that made them change their mind. Because in 2019, I remember talking to some of these large companies and asking about their cloud strategy and remote work and all these things. And typically the answer would be, especially in the creative industries, mm-hmm. The answer would be, no, it sounds great. We have a cloud strategy. The only thing is we don't let people work remotely. We don't allow them to work over the internet, and everything's air-gapped. And we don't put anything in the cloud, by the way. So how do you offer them a cloud native solution that allows remote collaboration over the internet? They just listed all the things that they're not allowed to do. So it was a hard sale. And when the pandemic hit, all that went out the window overnight.
Yeah, I guess luck is also an important factor. At the same time, you were prepared for this luck to be, put it this way. I wonder, maybe also because you know the trends when it comes to cloud and the predictions, how the industry is going to develop and where the how much space is there for LucidLink in the future. I'm sure that you're going to develop the company and adapt to the market trends. What I can see now is that cyber attacks are a growing concern for many, and I think even more companies are now considering solutions which are somehow not always in the cloud, or they're in a bit more protective cloud or their own cloud. How do you adapt to these trends, and where is LucidLink's place in this world?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I firmly believe that the cloud will give you better protection than putting your data on premise. Talking about trends, I can give you sort of my position in my industry, okay? Think of it this way. We came from, if I can make an analogy with money, mm-hmm. You have two choices. You can put your money in a safe box at home, mm-hmm. or you can put it in the bank. You may feel that it's better protected in your house, but it isn't. It's an illusion. Obviously, it's better protected in the bank. at the bank. Also, by virtue of moving it there, then you can tap into that resource from anywhere in the world. I can go to an ATM anywhere in the world and withdraw money. That's hard to do when I have my money at home. Also, how I make payments, for instance. I can make electronic payments instead of giving you, you know, stashes of paper money, right? So it changes how you work, how you conduct business. The same is true for data. We used to think that data is better protected in my data center, in my environment, at the office. That's an illusion. It is better protected in the cloud. The scalability, reliability, elasticity, and ultimately security is going to be better in the cloud. That's my firm belief. There's no reason why the most valuable resource should be sitting unprotected in a broom closet, mm-hmm. or, you know, in a server room, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And so the vision here is everything should go into the cloud. Of course, some of it will stay for niche applications, high performance, etc. But it's like the mainframe business. Yeah, they're mainframes. They're still being used. There are companies that do these things, but it's a small niche. And so the way we look at the industry is today this is a $50-60 billion industry, and it's all going to get sucked into the cloud. And I believe we are the best company to help that transition. So it's a huge opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I would like to also ask you another question, because I think you're in the unique position of being part of the Bulgarian Southeastern European ecosystem, and at the same time you're also big part and embedded in the States and in their innovation ecosystem. Which are the cultural differences that you see? And maybe also a trick question: do you believe that you could have grown LucidLink purely coming from the Bulgarian ecosystem if you weren't with one foot on mm-hmm. the other side of the ocean?
Right. Yeah, it is true that I kind of straddle both worlds. Can you start this business out of Bulgaria? Probably today, mm-hmm. but it's difficult, still very, very difficult. Yeah. I'll tell you why. But 20 years ago or 15 years ago, no. No, mm-hmm. it's impossible. For the most part, I believe that it is much easier to start a business in the U.S. For many different reasons, primarily because of the mindset of the can-do attitude mm-hmm. Of the American society, the belief in the impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to talk about Bulgaria, but Europe in general mm-hmm. is more this can be done, and over in the U.S. it's like, yeah, I can, mm-hmm. yes, we can do it, and so that mindset. You know, our DNA is the same. We are biologically the same, physiologically the same species, but we're fundamentally different because over in the U.S. people believe in the impossible and they will it into existence, mm-hmm. you know? Because when you start a business, if it's a truly innovative business, you're building something that hasn't been built before. So for the most part, that's a foolish endeavor, you know? You're building something that probably shouldn't be built or can't be built or it's not going to work. You know, there's many excuses not to build it. And so belief is a very important thing. Also, the entire ecosystem is designed around that. There's the investment ecosystem. Starting a company is very easy. All these things, right? So the environment is you know, I'm a product of the environment. Yeah. You know, without the U.S., I couldn't have built what I built. Starting out from out of Bulgaria, gosh, it's already so hard. Starting out of U.S., doing it out of Bulgaria would have been that much harder. Not impossible these days, but if I were starting out of Bulgaria, the first thing I would personally do is get outside. Okay. For first of all, because of the investment ecosystem. The investment ecosystem in Europe is growing and getting better and better, but it's still quite a bit more risk averse than it is over in the US. Mm-hmm. Valuations are higher, risk taking is at a higher level, all these things. So your chances of survival are much higher. Also, building a business out of Bulgaria, you have to structure it in a way so that it's not tied to the local market, because the local market is small. Mm-hmm. And I have friends who are great, you know, entrepreneurs, but they build businesses that are within the constraints of the local market. So they've saturated the market. There's nowhere to go, you know? And so it's a small business, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you got to do is jump outside those boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Jump outside in a way you actually physically move there, or?
There are many ways to do this. There's no single formula.
Important is the ecosystem of entrepreneurs around you. I don't know, peers that you're able to talk to. I was in the States for the first time last year, and it was for the first time that I actually got to talk to entrepreneurs who are based in the Silicon Valley. Of course, they're coming from all over the world. Yeah. And when they were sharing their ideas with me at first, I was like, oh my God, it sounds delusional almost. Like,
you it
know,
is.
It was much more ambitious. And then it, I mean, I know we've just closed our seed round of 5 million, 6 million. And I'm like, what? You know, these are rounds that we haven't heard of in this part of the world. So obviously, although I sense it is delusional, there are investors who actually believe in this model. So it wouldn't be, otherwise it wouldn't be investable. And I think being surrounded by people like that gives you also the optimism and the confidence that you actually need exactly in this first phase, which is one of the most difficult ones.
Right. I would imagine that, you know, there is some benefit in having this support network. But I have to tell you that entrepreneurship is a lonely, lonely thing, ultimately. You go alone in the end. I mean, with a partner, but it's still very lonely. So, yeah, you might get some emotional support, but you're not building it together. You're building it alone. So ultimately, it's, you know,
which is yours,
you, yourself, and I. Me, myself, and I, right?
Yeah. I have even a whole movie about myself. Me, myself, and Irene.
Yeah, there you go.
But, okay, even though limited, which is your support system?
So you can't do this by yourself. When I say it's lonely, it is, but it doesn't mean to say I did it alone. I did it with the help of many, many people. Okay. Starting out with friends who are just helping you for without any ulterior motive. They just want to see you succeed. We were fortunate to get a lot, to have few, but importantly, very good mentors and advisors who are giving you the courage, because there's nothing more powerful when somebody who you look up to tell you, I believe in you, you're special, you're different, you can do it. You know, the father figure, you need that, you know. You're still doing it alone, but you're, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. And when you have the right mentors, the right investors who believe in you, that's also a big part of it. That gives you a lot of power to keep going. So, but in the end, it's a lonely business.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a bit about the future. How far is Listling now going to get? How big is the ambition?
So,
I don't know, like paint a picture of what you see now in the future.
Right, right. There are different ways to measure the success of a company. But let's just say that this is a large enough market. It's a multi-billion dollar market, and it's up for disruption. The industry, excuse me, is going through a massive transformation where the bulk of the data, as I said, is moving to the cloud, and we're at the forefront of that transformation. So there's a huge opportunity in front of us. And if we do this right, we can build this into a multi-billion dollar business, not valuation, I'm talking about revenue. That's what we're after. You know, and that's what our investors, and that's the reason why our investors invested in this round. With each subsequent investment, the stakes go higher and higher and higher. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd have said, hey, if we get to 20, 50 million, I'd be happy. Today, we're talking about getting to 1 billion plus in revenue. That's what we're trying to accomplish. Whether we get there or not, time will tell. But that's where we're heading.
Okay. So it's not about the exit.
No.
No. Do you imagine?
No, it's the journey. It's not the destination.
Because you worked for DataCore 18 years before that, I was wondering, do you imagine yourself spending like the majority of the rest of your life with Lucidly?
I haven't looked at it that way. I don't know.
Okay.
It could be 1 month. It could be 10 years. It doesn't matter. What we're trying to do is build an enduring business,
mm-hmm.
not an exit. Because what's an exit? You know, I'm privileged to work with very successful people who've had multiple exits. And what do? They work for a startup like my own. And so, you know, what am I going to do? Exit and then what? Join another startup? Which one? Well, I kind of like our startup, so I might as well stick around. And so ultimately, exits don't matter.
Okay.
Yeah. It's about doing something that that you find fulfilling, that gives some meaning to your life, you know, professionally.
You know, because we celebrate exits in our industry a lot.
I know.
You know, founders who have many exits. You know, it just struck me right now that if you're able to create the company that you yourself want to work for.
How about that, huh?
How about that? I mean, it sounds even more fulfilling than all the exits that you can actually have. And it's very much true. Once a startup, always kind of like a startup. Some of them pivot to investors. We see that happening quite often as well. But when I look at VC funds, they pretty much also operate as startups, at least in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it seems to me even harder. What I've also seen is exited founders who shortly after that, I don't know, fall into a sort of an identity crisis, depression, and they don't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you...
Following an exit, you mean?
Exit, yeah. I haven't so far met startup founders who have built their own exit, built their own startups and exited it. And after that, I haven't seen them. I haven't seen a happy founder so far.
Post-exit.
It's a bit worrying.
That may be true.
To be honest, most of them are very, very different.
And by the way, I have to qualify what I said. You know, investors invest for a return. So they have to get a return on investment.
Yeah.
Right? And that's an important thing. But it's not necessarily exit as in selling the company. There are many different ways to get a return on investment.
Of course. Yeah.
And so at some point you have to look at that. But exit, like closing shop and going to the beach, that gets old pretty quick. You know, so what are you going to do 6 months after that, you know? I don't look at it that way. You know, we like what we're doing. We want to keep doing it for as long as we can. We want to grow this company. It all depends on our individual potential as well as the market conditions and many other factors. But we'll see. We'll see how far we can get. We certainly, I told you that I wanted to test myself, and that's how most people mm-hmm. think. The experiment continues. You know, we want to see how far we can get.
Mm-hmm.
It's not over yet.
And what I admire about your experiment is that you're not only testing it if you can do it, but you're trying to do it in an ethical way.
I hope so.
Can I do it? You know, get to that point, to the, not maybe you wouldn't consider it a personal success, but a success of the company, and at the same time be a good company that's actually treating people well, which
right.
I think is a different thing.
It is.
It's a different hack.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, it isn't necessary. In other words, mm-hmm. you don't have to be ethical in order to be to build a successful company, unfortunately. However, Peter and I believe that this is a competitive advantage in doing the right thing, doing it right, mm-hmm. being ethical. And so far, I think that this has worked well for us. So, of course, we're going to continue. But like I said, it's not a requirement, unfortunately, in the world we live in. Mm-hmm. For us, it worked great, and that's how we want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because we talked about work and obviously beach time is something great, but you get bored with it. I just wanted to ask you still, how do you balance out? How do you get to your healthy self.
Yeah.
What do you do?
It's not easy.
To maintain.
I have to admit it's not easy because sanity is important. And basically, when you sign up for this thing, you kind of forfeit sleep for, you know, 8-10 years, and that messes you up.
Definitely.
The other thing is that, you know, entrepreneurship, everybody has this sort of naive ideas how great it is. Well, there's certain very rewarding elements mm-hmm. in it. But for the most part, you give up a lot. You know, you give up the quote-unquote normal life. You know,
yeah.
People travel, they take vacations, they see the world, they have social lives, they go to parties, they read books, they watch Netflix. You know, all these things normal people do. You know, they have hobbies. You know, you kind of don't. You have to, you know, throw this by the wayside. And so it's a bit difficult to maintain sort of stability,
yeah.
stable mind, but it's necessary. So what I found to be working, I recently discovered that is actually sports. It's a cliche, but,
yeah.
you know, moving helps a lot. And so last year I signed up for Ironman 73.
Oh, wow.
I didn't finish it. I unfortunately... there was a strong current, so I didn't finish within the control time.
There is a difference between sports and Ironman. I mean, that's quite the
There is. There is. It's just, yeah. I need to have goals. And so I like to set the bar high. So without it, it's hard for me to maintain. So he asked me what I'm doing. So I'm going to sign up for another one and keep trying until hopefully one day we'll get there.
I love that.
Yeah.
Georgi, I think, I could continue chatting with you for quite a long time, but we need to kind of like wrap it up, or at least for the audience, we should continue talking. Thank you for this. Thank you for this humble reflection on entrepreneurship. I really loved the way that you put everything a bit into perspective, you know, at the same time being in the world of the storm. Yeah, you are still there, but you have a certain distance, and I see that you have been reflecting on your journey, on yourself, and what's actually happening. And quite often I believe that we entrepreneurs, we lack that, because you're in the middle of everything all the time. Yeah, and it's hard to take a step back and to see what is actually really happening right now, because you're so pressured by all the things which are urgent and important all the time.
100%.
Nothing can be bucketed somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in order to be successful, we have to have a certain philosophical point of view. You can't take yourself too seriously, you know.
You believe so?
Yeah. No, You cannot. It's just.
Do you joke about yourself also? Do you? I think self-irony is actually very important.
It is. Unfortunately, I'm not particularly good at that, but I don't take myself too seriously either in terms of like, oh, I'm the successful entrepreneur. No, I'm not. And I'll hug. You know, we're just, we're doing our best.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes do this exercise where I imagine myself being 90. Looking back.
Ah, there you go. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, oh my God, when you think about how many things are going to be relevant in, I don't know,
exactly.
10 years.
Right?
It's crazy.
It may seem like a big deal today. 10 years from now, it'll fade in the distance. So, you know, you just have to find some fulfillment and not take everything too seriously, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Georgi, thank you so much for being here and for sharing the time with us and your wisdom so far.
Thank you.
I wish you all the best. I love your motivation and aspirations, and I have admiration for the way that you're doing stuff. It's been always a bit my way to think about businesses, you know, not just to build a business and, I don't know, build it to a successful point, but can you actually do it in an ethical way, in a good way?
Can you?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere. This podcast episode is supported by EBRD. Support to small and medium-sized businesses is an important part of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's mandate. Activities to support small businesses include direct and indirect financing through partner institutions. The EBRD's Advice for Small Businesses team provides the knowledge, the network, and the skills to help emerging businesses innovate, thrive, and succeed.